Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and in this week's podcast, we're going to focus on the perplexing nature of the bond market. And to do so, we're going to speak to two fund managers, Jenna Barnard and John Petullo from Janus Henderson, who've navigated the recent bond market turbulence pretty well, taking a bullish view as bonds sold off earlier in the year and then benefiting from the subsequent recovery. But bear in mind, this is not investment advice. We can't guarantee sources from outside Brundolphin, and tax and legislation can change. Also, remember that when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can differ based on currency fluctuations, and future performance can change from that of the past. But now let's find out what drives the bond market. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Bruin podcast. And we're going to be exploring the world of bonds and interest rates and inflation with some of the best fund managers in the business, friends of the podcast, Jenna Barnard and John Petullo, who manage the range of strategic bond funds at Janus Henderson. So welcome both of you back to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think we're going to start with the big issue. You know, we are recording this just after the second in a couple of months of really sort of monster inflation prints in the United States, CPI prints. Both of them, both of the last 2 months, been big positive surprises, positive meaning higher than expected, and certainly something which was anticipated would be really bad news for the market. But risk assets quite liked it, and amazingly, even sovereign bonds seem to have been quite positive following those prints. So I wondered if you could talk to us about why you think it is that that markets are responding in this way.
Yeah, well, we, as you might know, Guy, we had a kind of game plan all year that we thought bond yields would likely peak in April, May. Rise into April, May time. And so we feel like actually the behaviour of bonds at the moment is entirely logical. And the reason for that is that bonds, sovereign bond yields, are really sensitive to the rate of change of the economic data. You know, are they accelerating? And are they accelerating at a faster pace, or is the data decelerating? It's not the level, it's the rate of change. So we always knew that in April, May, we were going to kind of have peak impulse in the economy. And I think a lot of those factors have been discussed before, things like base effects, the very weak data this time last year, the fiscal stimulus in the US in January, March, and then also the reopening of the economy in the US around that time. So bond yields peaking in line with that peak impulse in the economy, to us, is in line with how we've always traded government bond yields. It's completely logical. Now, I suppose the surprise has been that the absolute level of headline inflation is much higher than people thought in January. So the US just had this headline CPI print at 5%. You know, when I was looking at expectations in January, it was about 3.5 was the expectation, so yeah, much higher. But the nature of that beat, or the upside surprise in inflation, when you look at it, I mean, yeah, you know about used car prices, yep, all the kind of COVID benefited sectors, furnishing, recreation. You know, there's nothing in there apart from a little bit of an upturn in rent, which could be more significant, and it's, you know, worth watching.
Yeah, it could but have further that, to go that, couldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's a very long cycle that within the inflation cycle. And obviously a really core part of the inflation story. So, you know, I think people are just having a really hard time arguing it's not transitory when you look at the root cause of these higher prints. So as we sit here today, I think bond yields, you know, are moving down in expectation of that, you know, peak impulse in the economy. And then we're starting to see signs that this inflation could actually burn itself out.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so if you look at consumer perception of whether it's a good time to buy a house, a car, household furnishings, these are just absolutely collapsed in the last couple of months. I mean, for housing, you're back to the lowest since the early 1980s. Vehicles are back to the great financial crisis, the 08 lows. So the idea that this inflation is kind of self-sustaining and that people are going to continue to pay up with this rate of change of inflation isn't borne out with, I mean, this is University of Michigan data, which you can dig out yourself or whatever, but actually in the surveys, the early signs are that actually it potentially could kill itself. It's just too fast. So I think the bond market, you know, it's always forward looking. It's always sniffing out inflection points. And we feel actually much more comfortable with what bond yields are doing now and the timing of this move down in bond yields.
So how confident, I mean, do you think there's any chance that, what are we, so that was May's print, that June's print could be as high as May's print? I mean, I'm just asking that obviously with the question that, is this the inflection point? I think most people think it is the inflection point, but is that potentially where the surprise could come?
I mean, whether this month, next month, I mean, I think the big question here is we are at the peak, or looks like we're at peaky inflation prints and inflation expectation prints, which inflation expectations are starting to come down as well, for what it's worth. At this point in the cycle, you can either A, extrapolate out, or B, mean revert. Which of those do we are much more comfortable in the mean reversion camp for some of the reasons I've discussed just a moment ago. But, you know, much of this inflation, whether it ships in the wrong place, used car pricing, I mean, everybody knows about this. It's in the price. Arguably, it's been in the price for a few months in the bond market. And at this point, you really need to put your, you know, decide whether you're in the mean reversion camp or the extrapolation camp. And as I said, we're not seeing any reasons to extrapolate out. You know,
so
predicting inflation in the next month or so, I'm not really in that game.
Sure.
But I suppose my final point would be, regardless of our view, which could be right or wrong, we're just fund managers, the bond market has been resolutely in the central bank camp that this is transitory all year. It's really interesting. So if you look at inflation expectations that bond market's printing, pricing in 10 years' time relative to 2 years' time, that curve is inverted. So you're pricing in lower inflation in 10 years or 5 years relative to 2 years, which is really, really unusual for the bond market. But that's been going on since January. And I'd say, you know, this bond market sell-off that we've had is all about that acceleration in growth and inflation into April. For us, it's completely normal. It wasn't about regime shift in inflation. Now, we'll see later this year whether that comes. And we're going to get a lot of interesting data to see how sticky it is, how much is transitory, how much is not. But this is not dissimilar to the experience in 2010, 2011. Do you remember UK CPI printing above 5%?
Yeah.
US CPI above 4. European CPI above 3. And Trichet hiked twice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So coming out of a recession, you get these massive commodity moves. You get these, you know, obviously this one is enormous, but it's not unusual. And I think the bond market has been pretty resolute in the central bank camp that this is transitory, and we wouldn't disagree. And it's really important to understand that, because I think when government bonds sell off for normal cyclical reasons, there's a lot of bond bears out there. You say, this is it. This is the regime shift. I've been waiting for this for 10, 20, 30 years. I knew it was coming.
This is what we've been training for.
This is it. I'm finally right. And I think just, you know, really looking at what the bond market's saying and understanding the reasons for the move is important. You know, it's too early to know whether there's a regime shift, frankly. It's a real mess out there in terms of dislocations in the economy, the inflation prints. So we've lengthened duration on our funds materially this year, from the low end of the range pretty much to the high end of the range. And investing based on that kind of what we view as a normal cyclical framework, rate of change framework.
Well, there's a great segue then. So, I mean, we talked a little bit about this before, but you mentioned the cyclical framework. Where are we, do you think, then, in this cycle? Because as we were saying just before we started recording, you know, this cycle so far has progressed so quickly that do you think we're a long way through the cycle? Are we sort of mid-cycle already, despite barely being out of recession?
Yeah, sure. I'll have a go at that, Guy. I think it depends which asset class you're talking about, really. But certainly the easiest one to answer is really credit spreads. I mean, credit spreads are very tight and are pretty much late cycle. So volatility is at 15-year lows. The distress ratio in high yield bonds is at 15-year lows. The VIX or any other move index, whatever you want to measure of volatilities, are very low. And actually, I was actually just checking earlier, like LBOs are creeping up already. So actually, just like last week, Medline Industries, which is a big medical supplier, that's a $30 billion LBO, second largest, I think, or one of the largest ones on record. You know, so people, you know, that scare that a lot of people had in COVID and the corporate behaviors or something, there is some evidence that animal spirits are, you know, a bit hot and a bit frothy in the credit markets. Equity markets obviously have rotated, you know, to reflation, and correctly so. And now, you know, with a flatter and more bullish yield curve, arguably they may be going slightly more mid-cycle, back to sort of quality growth, if you like. So it's a bit of a muddle, frankly, Guy. But we think this reflation thing is definitely coming to an end, for what it's worth, you know, the cyclicals and the financials and all that stuff and the bottlenecks that Jen was speaking about. So that's all, in our opinion, is going to happen. That's kind of the story we've had. And there's limited value, which I know is one of your next questions, in the credit markets. And that's really why we've added duration. I think duration was actually the mispriced asset here. And just to give your listeners a bit of color, bonds were awful in February and March, and they were selling off very heavily, predominantly due to Japanese selling on no economic data towards the Japanese year end in March. And that's where people, in our opinion, were getting a bit hysterical about inflation and regime change. And then, you know, unusually, we do agree with Ed in this transitory point. And they've, you know, everyone's short bonds, and then there's been this rally back, and they sort of squeezed back to, frankly, more sensible levels. It, you know, in our opinion. So they were certainly oversold back in March, whether they actually clubbed. And then, of course, when they sell off, people get more bearish. And, you know, as a fund manager, you've got to say, well, hang on, these things are cheaper, you know, and not much has changed. And the rate of change in growth inflation was, you know, falling over as or was moving along the line and has peaked in the last month or two. So I think that's probably more interesting for us. And to us, the real question is, you know, post-COVID, are people going to borrow and spend more money and be more buoyant than they were pre-COVID? And net, we just find that remarkably hard to accept, that people will borrow and spend more money. And we were an economy which was quite structurally, you know, quite a structured stagnation economy anyway. So this bounce back, which we've had, which was welcome and anticipated, we think is a bit front loaded. We think we're quite far through it already. We've got retail sales coming out later this week. And we actually think people have changed their behaviors and corporates in a number of ways, which we might want to come on to when you're ready.
Yeah, sure. And just to finish this point off then. So for when you see articles and news items about how much longer the chip shortage is going to last and how big the queues outside ports are growing.
Yeah.
None of that is ever likely to really sway you.
Well, the thing is, it's badflation. And as Jenna said, it's burning itself out. So, you know, if everybody speculated in timber or lumber prices, people start hoarding it, the price goes up and up and up and up, and that stops activity. You know, builders stop work, you know, cars are stopped being made because they haven't got the semiconductors and so on. And that's restrictive. Yeah, that's bad news. That's badflation. That's a classic supply side tax on activity. You go and fill up your car, you've probably got an EV guy, but you fill up your petrol car, you know, you've got less money in your pocket because the price of petrol's gone up. So we don't really worry about, broadly speaking, any of that stuff. It will work itself out. You know, the supply chains are a bit just in time. I think a lot of people accept that. But we, broadly speaking, I think a lot of that stuff will work its way out. And there is a risk that you might have a glut, not so much in semiconductors, but you might have a glut of some of this stuff in months and years to come, because, you know, most of these things can be produced. We can just produce more, but just not today when demand is really strong. And that's the key point about inflation. You know, persistent long-term inflation is too much demand for the supply. We just got supply mismatches in various industries, copper, tin, aluminium, lumber, whatever. But that will sort itself out. And I just don't see a world where there is a chronic shortage of all this stuff in a longer term, permanent, sustainable way.
Okay, well, you talked about how the tightness of markets now could cause a bit of a glut cyclically in the future. But let me just ask you, even though I think you're trying to avoid this difficult long-term question, but, you know, over the beyond this sort of this cyclical move, what is your outlook for the kind of inflationist, deflationist perspective over the longer term? And I say that really because I guess a lot of people are saying the sort of waning influence of China is and the deglobalization efforts is going to cause this kind of long-term inflection point. So it'd be great to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, okay, so what's different about coming out of this crisis from the GFC is definitely the willingness of policymakers to run the economy hot, yeah, and actually wanting to overshoot on inflation. And that, I would say, gives us the most pause for thought. Yeah, it's very difficult to the 2010 fashion for austerity. Do you remember that Reinhardt and Rogoff book said if you went over 90% debt to GDP, your long-term growth prospects would, you know, fall?
One with the spreadsheet era.
Yeah, with the spreadsheet era, found a couple of years later. Okay, so completely different policymaker backdrop, willingness backdrop, the ability to create a regime shift in inflation, I think comes from the private sector. Whether that's, as John said, the velocity of money, which is driven by commercial bank lending, yeah, or businesses. You know, there's a Washington Post article at the weekend talking about how hotels post-COVID were no longer going to do daily room cleaning service. And this could take out, I think, about 40% of housekeeper jobs in US hotels. And they've discovered actually the customers quite like this. Obviously, it's good for the businesses, profit margin. Restaurants and the app. You know, I just went to a restaurant last week where all the serving staff did was deliver the food, didn't interact at all, other than that. So I think like the whole narrative about an inflation regime shift is focused on policymakers, the one-off fiscal and monetary response, the willingness to drive inflation in the future. But whether they're successful at that, I think, is really down to the private sector. And, you know, we've been talking about bank loan growth contracting all year because there's no demand for credit. There's no demand for credit. And I hope that picks up in the next year or so and it's just cyclical. But that's the Japanese, that's European experience. And it's being replicated in the US as we speak. So, you know, we'll see. I think this debate becomes more fertile for markets at the end of this year, as we get through this cyclical repricing and these messy inflation numbers. But I think we lean more on the disinflationary side, whether it's the COVID impact on inequality, tech, demographics. I mean, it all seems to play into quite disinflationary forces. It's just we had a very potentially inflationary response from the fiscal and monetary side for a short period. So we'll see. You know, it's a watching brief. And as I said, our approach to bonds this year has all been cyclical, not structural. Coming out of a big recession, there's always uncertainty. There's more inflation uncertainty now than there normally is. But we don't buy this kind of big inflation shift that a lot of people are pushing.
No. And I might just add, I mean, it's kind of obvious, but, you know, the rate of change of digitalization in so many industries due to COVID has just accelerated and has become, in our opinion, more deflationary. You know, I mean, if you walk through an airport, the automation, if you were to walk through an airport, you know, automation is all over the place. You know, like healthcare, like Babylon, which might be IPO, you know, NHS app where you can get a video consultation with a doctor. You know, everyone is sitting at home and streaming Amazon Prime. I mean, their viewing numbers are up massive. And that's a massive structural shift for the cinema industry, let alone the office industry. HSBC, they said they've got 20% less demand for office space, 40% less demand for office space longer term. They've halved their travel budget. you know, some of these things are kind of leapfrog technologies, which in our opinion aren't going to go back to, oh, we always did it that way, so that's how we're going to do it again, let alone, you know, things like migration and fertility rates and loads of things, and internet shopping, where Britain actually leads the world. I think internet shopping is almost 40% of all online sales now, you know, and people aren't going to go back to, oh, you know, go, if they weren't doing it previously, well, they've changed now. So net net, I would actually argue that COVID has just accelerated the rate of change of digitalization, and that has made the world more deflationary, longer term in the structural sense, and unfortunately probably more inequitable, even though the Fed has got very honourable intentions to get higher employment in minority income groups and so on. So yeah, we're more sympathetic to that in the long term.
I might just chip in actually, if that's all right.
And of course.
You can respond. But our inboxes as fund managers have virtually no comment on these long-term structural factors. Yeah, we just get emails on the bond market from orthodox economists, you know, who can plug fiscal and monetary multipliers into their models and spit out a number. But the kind of really good thinking about how the world's going to change post-COVID, and once we're through the fiscal and monetary response, whether it's inflation or deflation, I mean, you have to get that from think tanks, academics. You know, Washington Post has a labour market journalist. It's just, you know, it's just you're not going to get it from the bog standard consensus forecast. But it's going to be incredibly profound, some of these shifts. You know, I don't know how you could argue working from home is inflationary. I really don't, but I'm sure someone will. But, you know, but the point is, you can't put this in a standard economic model that the chief economist of the investment bank spits out. And so it's longer term. It's really important for the next 10 years. And but there's, you know, as I said, it's very hard to get the research passively, you know, to passively get it in your inbox. You have to actively kind of seek it out. So
yeah.
So you know, this plays into a decade, two decades of over forecasting bond yields and not taking account of these factors.
No, absolutely.
You know, same old, same old.
And as bond managers, you know, we've always had a kind of bias to large cap quality, non-cyclical businesses. And obviously the portfolio held up pretty well during the COVID crisis. But to be honest, I think those trends are even stronger. You know, the winners will win, and the loser sort of analog old fashioned models, I think, will really struggle, completely, except you've had a kind of cyclical uptick and all the cyclicals have done outperform growth, but that's now reversing, you know, and don't confuse a kind of cyclical change with something going on longer term structurally. And, you know, we try and buy the bonds, or if we were equity managers, we're buying the equities of the quality growth businesses, which are going to be winners and are genuinely sustainable for decades to come, because those are the bonds we want to lend to. Because that will look after the cash flows for our clients.
Okay, so nice one for the to bring us back to the present day then. How long do you think the Fed can stay with this very accommodative stance?
You go, John.
I think quite a long time, Guy. I mean, they are pretty well. I mean, we can say they've got ESG, if you're with me. Because they're now emphasizing the unemployment rate across all categories. You know, they've always had a dual mandate, but to be honest, they've all probably always erred a bit more in fighting inflation, as witnessed in, you know, 2017, 18, 19. So I think actually for a couple of years, I think the bigger issue really is what would peak rates be and what would they look like? Mm-hmm. And we're just not convinced they're that high due to the lack of growth, limited inflation for those secular reasons we discussed, and there's not much productivity in the world either. So I just still quite sympathetic to modestly lower bond yields from here forwards. Obviously, that there will be a taper discussion probably at Jackson Hole in August. That's no surprise. They are obsessed by not making a mess of a whole tapering discussion. I mean, you know, like, you know, they're absolutely obsessed of overly communicating. And Powell, to be fair, wasn't communicating this transitory point very well a couple of months ago, but his most recent preference, because he's done a pretty good job on this actually, so sure, yeah, I think rates may tick up in back end of 22-23, but not by an awful lot, and I don't think it will be particularly newsworthy if they manage it correctly.
So in terms of what you're doing with the portfolio, you've already told us that the risk you're taking then is duration risk rather than credit risk. But presumably you are doing some stuff within the credit markets. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Well, I'd say what we're doing in credit, we were super bullish on credit all of last year. And the mantra was that defaults are decoupled from the GDP decline. And it was a really unusual cycle. And then I'd say by the end of 2020, it was all priced in. You know, we were at close to cycle tights in credit. The value areas of the market had rallied strongly. And credit markets just moved at warp speed to price in the recovery, whereas equities took much longer to do the rotation into value in a convincing way. And so we've generally been leaning out from credit rather than leaning in at these valuations. Because you could make the argument that you can find great relative value opportunities in credit, but we're at the tightest spreads in history when you adjust for the longer duration, lower quality nature of the index. So at the tightest ever spreads, do you want to find those relative value opportunities? Because they're normally cheap for a reason, frankly. So we've actually been leaning out, been taking the credit beta down somewhat. Not saying that there's any particular catalyst that we see on the horizon. As John said, the stressed ratio, which is a lead indicator of defaults, is at an all-time low. That's bonds trading at a very low cash price.
Mm.
That's at an all-time low. So I don't think there's anything in credit you could point to as particularly worrying. It's just at these valuation levels, it's a bit uncomfortable, frankly. And it, you know, not unusual for credit to pass the baton over to equities after the initial recovery phase. And
yeah,
it's been remarkably dull, remarkably dull. I think the realized volatility in credit is at decade or two decade lows. So in equities, you've had all this sector rotation,
yeah,
volatility spikes, nothing. Credit, nothing. It's just remarkable. Yeah, it's expensive for good reason. But also there's a lack of opportunity because it's not moving. And there's not really any themes to get your teeth into in particular. So, John, I don't know if you want to chip in.
No, I just think, you know, you just got to be brutally honest with clients. There's not much to go for, and we are not going to force it. We don't do illiquids. We don't do exotics. We don't do fancy structured products. We don't push it. And I think there's a level of yield where if you invest in, you're almost guaranteed to lose capital. And we call that fool's yield. You know, because you can believe the advert on the tube that someone can actually give you a 12% return and not blow up your capital. I mean, it's just absurd, isn't it? But people almost want to have to believe this. What we secretly are kind of hoping for is a bit of a mini volatility squall, if you like, for some left field event. And then we'd probably add risk on the back of that, to be brutally honest. But sometimes you just got to have a bit of patience, a bit of perspective. And just be honest. It's nothing wrong with credit. It's just sort of reassuringly expensive again. You know, investment grade bond spreads are less than 1%, but in the eye of the storm, they were 4% in late March of 2020. And ironically, of course, you know, people were understandably quite scared there. You know, we were buying credit back then, and now we're just, you know, the other side of the boat. So sometimes you just got to have some perspective on it. Credit spreads won't be low forever. There'll be opportunities. And we're biding our time.
Okay, well, look, that's great. But just before I let you go, and I'm really grateful for the generous time you've afforded to us and our listeners, I was just wondering if you could talk about how you integrate ESG and what relevance that has to the decisions that you're making and your portfolio management.
Sure. We have always been the view that we are stewards of our clients' capital. You know, and if you actually think about what sustainable means, that means you want to lend to a quality business which is going to be around for decades, which does the right thing, and it doesn't pollute not only the environment, but doesn't pollute its stakeholders or pollute one stakeholder at the expense of another. So if you like, it's about doing the right thing and lending to businesses which not only achieve a decent return for their shareholders, but they look after their customers and their clients and their employees and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Our style investing is particularly appropriate because, as you know, we don't actually support the oil industry or the energy industry or the shipping industry because they destroy clients' capital. So we are more sympathetic to those quality businesses which are genuinely sustainable for decades to come. And we are really interested in finite management teams who've got a 5-year track record, who just want to get all their LTIPs to crystallize and then they're off to do something else. So the very definition of sustainable means, if you like, doing the right thing, but also it means resilient in a cash flow and doing the right thing for the future for all stakeholders. And on the back of that, I think Jenna and I are pretty proud of the way we lend our clients capital out and engage with companies to ensure that they do the right thing. Because everyone knows what doing the right thing is about. Yeah, it's not complicated. You just have to be a bit more proactive and focus on it. So I think our style lends to it, but also, you know, we've invested heavily in Janet Henderson in this. A lot of it is back-end data systems to monitor and engage and present it to you know, clients like yourself. But we think we're pretty well set up here. But it's an evolving and revolving subject, yeah? And we're focused on it. But I just think you've got to really define sustainable in the broadest sense. I think everyone knows what that really means.
Okay. That's brilliant. Well, John, Jenna, thank you so much for your time and for talking us through, and congratulations on getting your positioning so well for this period. Thanks also to all of our listeners for joining us for another Brewin podcast. Hopefully you found this dive into the bond market helpful, and hopefully you will join us again for a future edition.